exceptionnel. Oh, 25 points. That's a brilliant bit of follow-up play by Mahé. Oh my goodness me, what a shot.
Sagolsen. Sagolsen setter det hen. Han setter den. De I semifinale.
Today on the Uninformed Handball Hour, we have a bumper edition. It's going to be jam-packed full of wonderful guests and wonderful games. Mm. And we're going to start off with a preview of the semifinals in a different way. We're going to have Chris and Asko head-to-head, finally. We're going to find out who knows their stuff more.
And later on in the podcast, we have two big interviews and two very enjoyable interviews as well. We're going to speak to Hannah Fogelström, acclaimed TV expert on Swedish TV. She's also an EHF Euro 2014 bronze medalist with the Swedish women's national team. And we've got two referees on as well, Boris Milosevic and Mattia Gubica, who refereed the last men's EHF Euro final.
So we've finally gone from 24 teams to the final four. Semi-final number one, Spain-Slovenia. Semi-final number two, Norway-Croatia. For this first semi-final of Spain-Slovenia, we have, in the blue corner, Chris O'Reilly, ladies and gentlemen. And in the red corner, for Spain, we have Alex Softhands Kulesh.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be here.
Now, I'm so ready. I am so ready.
So this is going to work as follows. We're going to have two rounds for each semi-final. Each round is going to be followed by a rebuttal, and each round is going to last 30 seconds. We're going to start off with Chris, as I said at the top, representing Slovenia. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You have 30 seconds to make your case why Slovenia are going to beat Spain. Your 30 seconds begins now.
They are dynamic. They are creative and smart. They're basically like Spain, but younger and fitter. They're completely rested and have a shorter trip to Stockholm, and that is an important thing after 2.5 weeks of major championship handball. Their youth and speed will tell until the end. Lubomir Vanez, he orchestrated one of the greatest victories over a Spanish team in a semi-final when Flensburg beat Barcelona at the Velux EHF Final Four in 2014. It's time for another one.
Woo! That's good. Ooh. That's good. Alex is sweating over here. Woo! I can see that. It's a great start. Chris O'Reilly is very happy with himself. Alex, you are representing Spain. Are you ready? This is why Alex thinks Spain are going to win that semi-final number one.
Spain have been the best team in this competition. They have spread out their minutes so they're not tired. They have the best wingers in this competition. There are four of them. They've scored 76%, the wingers. Slovenia have nothing like that. We have size for Spain. Villar Moros and Guardiola have been there. They've done that. And they will lock up these Slovenian playmakers.
There we have it. Chris, you now have 30 more seconds to respond to Alex Kulesh. Okay? You've listened to him. He's talked about the wings they have, the size advantage. Are you ready? It's time for your rebuttal.
Size? Have you seen Blaz Blagotinshek? Have you seen Borat Maczkowsek? They are going to be incredible this weekend. I have a feeling. My dark horse, I'll mention that later. And the playmakers, come on, you've got so many to choose from. And Yura Dolanes at right back, he knows these Spaniards inside out. He's having the career-defining tournament. The wingers, Blaz Jantz on the right, he is as good as their players, but look at Dejan Bombats. He is going to have a whale of a time.
There you go, Alex. Alex, it's time for your response. Dry off those sweaty hands. And let's get talking. Your rebuttal, Alex.
Maczkowsek and Blagotinshek have been weak in the group stages and in the main round. They're the two guys. If they're the two guys you're relying on, you're going to have a lot of trouble. Spain have the backcourt. They have the wingers. They have the line players. And they have the best goalkeepers. Who is going to score past Perez de Vargas, the best goalkeeper in the competition so far? Not Bombats.
Well, you're both very good at keeping in time. The time frame, yeah. Thank you very much. It makes my job as hosting very easy over here. So, Chris, let's open this discussion up a little bit here. What were some of his strongest points you think he made?
Well, I think the very good
point is the goalkeepers, but I did have a rebuttal for that, which I didn't have time to talk about. And that was the fact that Clement Ferlin and Ur Kastelic are a very underrated goalkeeper pair. I think they, when it comes to the two goalkeepers together and what they're capable of, I think they're going to be able to match up pretty well. And who can beat Gonzalo Perez de Vargas? Very difficult question, but maybe his Barcelona teammate, Yuri Dolonets. We'll find out. The thing about the two big men, as long as they can defend, that's the most important thing. But what he said about Blagotinshek is very, very accurate. He hasn't been that great at this championship. 61% scoring from a line player isn't wonderful, but also if you think about the amount of balls he didn't catch as well, that is a huge worry, I would say. But I think that the likes of Veron Morris and the rest of the defense, they haven't been so rock solid against the speedy and the agile players as they used to be. Maybe they're getting a bit old, so we'll see.
Alex, Spain getting old?
Slovenia haven't played a good team yet. They haven't beaten a top team yet. So Sweden was their big win in the group stages. We found out that Sweden not quite at the races this time. They lost to Hungary in absolute shock. They didn't get to play Norway. They haven't really been fully tested. Spain have. Spain have had their half of collapsing today against Croatia.
They didn't win, though.
They didn't win, but this is their shock. This is their shock. They are like, so I mentioned Russia in the World Championship last year. Spain have had a very similar tournament where they cruise through the group stages, cruise through the main round, and the difference is Russia had their big test in the semi-final. And when they got flustered, they couldn't recover. Spain have had that already. I think they're going to be mentally very strong and have, a mental upper hand against Slovenia as the favourites.
Okay. There you have it. Two very good arguments. I'm not going to decide what the better argument is or which the better argument is. I'm going to let the listeners on Twitter tell us who won this bout. So round two is the dark horse, which will prove to be key in your given teams. So we're going to start this time with Alex in the red corner. You're going to have 30 seconds again with some lovely countdown music once more. Are you ready?
My dark horse is Dani Sarmiento, the forgotten man of this Spanish team. A man who wasn't in the Champions League this year. He's been in France. People forget just how good he is. He makes this team tick. And they have the back players, and all Dani Sarmiento has to do is play the back players, play the line, and Spain win.
Alex Kulish finishing with some time to spare. That's arrogance.
Arrogance or not having enough to say.
Okay, Chris, time for your dark horse.
I have a feeling it'll be a similar length.
Does your dark horse have four or two legs? Let's go.
My dark horse has occasionally four legs when he's on the ground, and that's Blaž Blagotinshek. We're mentioning him for the third time here. I couldn't mention any of the other players because they're all just so good and obvious players that could win this semi-final. But all he has to do is somehow do better than the rest of the championship, which is not a difficult thing to do. The backcourt will occupy Spain big time, and that means the big, big man waiting on the line just needs to catch a few balls, and he will make the difference.
Oh, it's a man we brought up before, Blaž Blagotinshek. Alex, what do you think? Did Chris make a good case?
You mentioned Blagotinshek again, and I'm going to mention the Spanish defenders again and their size, and that's what Slovenia struggled against. That's why they lost against Hungary. They couldn't handle those big boys who could drag down Blagotinshek, but also keep tabs with the backcourt players who, of course, any one of them can have a great game, Slovenian. But I don't think Zarabets is the guy who's going to ignite that team. I think it all comes down to Bombats, and he struggled against Hungary. So that's why I think he'll struggle again.
I agree with that. He is the key one, but I couldn't put him as a dark horse. It's very obvious. And that's why I feel there are so many big players in this team that I kind of had to go to Blagotinshek, because if you say Dolonets, it's an obvious choice. If you say Blazians, kind of an obvious choice. Bombach as well. Even Zarabets as the second choice centre back is not like a big surprise. I think they'll start probably with Maćkowszek. They'll give it a go, and then at some point it'll be Bombach playing in the left hand side and Zarabets in the centre. I think you're giving the Spanish defense a bit too much credit. But at the end of the day, I reckon Spain do have the edge coming into this game. And there's a reason why they've been so good for this championship. There's only so much I can defend Slovenia. Like, I mean,
I really showed your colours.
I want Bombats to have a really good game. We're too civil. We're too civil.
I'm very polite for a debate.
So, are we tore each other apart at the beginning?
Okay. So, as I said, I'll let the listener decide who won that. I think we should swiftly move on to semi-final number two. Norway versus Croatia. In the red corner, we have Alex representing Croatia. In the blue corner, we have Chris O'Reilly representing Norway. Just like before, we're going to have some opening statements plus a rebuttal. This time, Chris is going to go first. His opening statement on Norway.
I did say that Slovenia were rested coming into this one, but Norway even more so. They played their third team today in the last game, the main round. Yes, it's all about Sander Sagason, but Christian O'Sullivan, Goran Sugard are going to be so instrumental this week. And we talked about Ruud being injured being a big loss, but Harald Reinkind, he's not actually as poor as we've been joking off air. 56% shooting, and he scored 18 goals. Not bad at all. Recent history is on their side, and Croatia are bottlers.
Ooh, got that. In just in time there, Chris O'Reilly. Alex Kulesh, it's time for your case for your team, Croatia.
I think Norway made a mistake by winning this last game. Croatia are the team that are going to cause them trouble. They have a 5-1 defense, completely locks up the backcourt. They slow things down. Croatia have only conceded an average of 23 goals in the main round group. That's because they slow. And we've seen Norway struggle against, when they can't rip through teams, they start to struggle. And Croatia are going to do it to them.
Chris, are we ready? Time for your rebuttal. Are you ready?
I'm ready. 5-1 defense. Sander Sagason will love a 5-1 defense. It means he gets to dance around Domagoj Duvnjak all day long. You see how much enjoyment he gets out of fighting with opposition teams? Norway are too intense to be dragged into a battle by Croatia. They love a good fight. And an average of 23 goals? Well, that's all it took to beat Sweden. They conceded 20. Oh, I've got lots more time. Sagason has averaged just 40 minutes. He's fresh. He's ready. He's going to make history.
Wow.
A lot of time there.
Yeah, you kind of went into your own...
Yeah, well, you just said Sagason a bunch of times. It's pretty easy when that's your rebuttal.
Sander Sagason is the rebuttal.
Alex, your 30 seconds begins now.
Take out Sagason and take out Ruud now. What is the depth of this squad? You're really relying on Sugor and Christian O'Sullivan. I think Christian O'Sullivan may struggle with that 5-1 because Sagason will not be playing the one. He'll be playing the back to give him more space. Duvnjak will have Christian O'Sullivan and Croatia will have Sagason.
I think it says a lot that all Alex can do is focus on Norway in this.
The reason why I didn't focus because I don't need to mention Sindrich, I don't need to mention Karacic, and I don't need to mention Duvnjak. Everyone knows that, as I've said previously, one of them having a great game like today, Karacic, 10 goals out of 12 shots, one of them is going to show up.
There may only be one of them there. If Sindrich is actually injured and Karacic doesn't get over his little clash of knees from today, who knows? But like you say, you take out Sagason or you take out Sugard or whatever, you're mentioning three players that they're focusing on. It's the same for Croatia. There's three players to focus on. And they can't all play. They could all play in the backcourt, but it won't look very pretty. And that's where I think the big downfall is for this team. And I think Christian Berge is a better tactician. You know, I think he'll be able to outthink the Croatian bench.
I'll go back to my first point, and I think it is that slow, slow game, a slog which Norway have struggled with. And I think that's the absolute key. I think they just, they're going to rely on individual play too much when it's that slow, because they're not going to be able to get their fast breaks. They're not going to be able to get their second wave fast breaks going. And that's why Sagosen is going to take, he's going to keep going one-on-one. And I think Croatia just, so Sagosen can, he can win that battle on himself. But I think it just becomes much more difficult for Norway.
Difficult, yes. But they'll win.
I genuinely think Croatia, I think.
What?
I genuinely think Croatia
will win.
Because of the way they played. And I think Croatia have shown ridiculous grit in this tournament. Both against Germany and Spain. There are 5 goals down.
I think yes, but they could go 12 goals down against Norway the way these games start. They have to, Croatia have to be on the ball from the very start. They have to drag it down into a scrap at the very start, or they could find themselves 7 goals down before they know it. And I think in a semi-final, Croatia have dragged their way back up 2 times, yes, but doing it again. Remember who we're talking about here. It's Croatia. Alex, what do you say about Croatia?
It's a new decade.
Who's your dark horse?
Move on to round 2. Dark horse for round 2 will begin this time with Alex Kulesh for Croatia. Alex Kulesh at the ready. Your time begins.
I think the dark horse is Stepančić. He is the 4th man in this Croatian team. And he is pretty much their only shooter. If he can shoot, it comes down, I think it will be a big battle between Stepančić and Ryan Kidd, whose other guy is going to have a better game. And I think Stepančić will. At least he'll have a better game than Tangen.
You had like 4 seconds to spare, so you just threw an insult.
Oh,
God, that was entertaining. Chris O'Reilly, your dark horse. Time starts now.
For anyone who actually knows this Norwegian team and has followed them over the last few years, he's a dark horse, but only because he wants to be. It's Christian O'Sullivan. Dark horse should be his middle name. He just plays so beautifully throughout this championship, and somehow he's getting better as well. His shooting has improved, he's being more decisive, and he will do everything right for 60 minutes. If it's a case of setting up the 4th players in the team, he will do that with aplomb. He'll come up with a few goals as well. He will be the match winner.
There you have it. Christian O'Sullivan and Stepančić. I was surprised you didn't pick Johansson for your dark horse, maybe.
He's the 2nd player in the team. I think he's...
He is Sagosen Jr.
Yeah. I think it's come to a point now where we know that Jóran Sugard is great. Mm. I think he's just... he's getting the recognition in the main round, I think, as being a really, really important player. And that's why I think the dark horse is going to be O'Sullivan, because he's going to kind of come back in and reclaim his spot.
Stepančić?
Stepančić has done well. He has shown up when he needs to in this tournament. And as long as all he needs to do is have a consistent game. He doesn't need to, you know, have his blockbuster game, because one of the other guys will. He just needs a bit of consistency when they throw him the ball to shoot from 9-10 meters. And I think he can do it. And Croatia will only need 22 goals.
Chris, have we seen Stepančić on the biggest stage performing?
We've seen him on the biggest stage.
Yeah.
Performing well?
The end.
Not really.
Yeah. No, I think you have to rebuttal him, don't you?
I know. I think Torbjørn Bergerud will have him in his pocket.
Norway have lost all their steam.
What? They just put out their 3rd choice team and got a victory over Slovenia.
Who, in fairness, had their 2nd choice team.
Yeah, but 3rd choice against 2nd choice. I mean, you said it at the start of that game. Slovenia's team looked pretty decent still.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sander Sagosen had a lovely 60 minutes wrapped up, giving out some water. And I think he's going to come in and, like, it's his tournament. He has to win the semi-final.
What do you think of Chris's statements about Christian O'Sullivan? Do you think he's the man who's going to come up with the goods when needed.
I like Christian Sullivan. I do think he can control the game. But again, I think the 5-1 defense, he's a key. But I think Duvnjak is a better number one defender than Christian Sullivan is a center player in that case.
I think the problem with this, if Croatia do stick with a 5-1 defense, is that the whole backcourt, or the O'Sullivan, Sugat, and Sanders Agusson are great at beating the first man. I think they will be able to beat Duvnjak one against one, and that will tear apart this whole 5-1 defense.
No, but it's not beating the first man. Duvnjak is the helper defender. The first man is the number two defender in front.
Sagason will take him on, though.
He will take him on, and then Duvnjak is there to just... Sagason's going to be, I see a man one-on-one. So instead of having the player come in from behind to support after Sagason beats one player, they're getting Duvnjak to come in at the exact point where Sagason is just about to beat the first player. And I think that is the slight bit of difference. And Norway's don't have Bjarne Myrhol.
The line players have been very good.
The line players have been very good, but their Musa is just going to be tearing Overby to shreds.
Oh, big statement. Big statement.
Just like tearing him down. Nothing, because Overby is very good. He moves a lot, yeah. And that can work in the against the 5-1. But Musa's just not going to let him move.
I don't see it happening. Have we not seen a similar situation with... Gieseland, it wasn't quite 5-1 now, but Gieseland come up very high on Sanders Agusson, and we saw him getting roughed up a bit. But as we saw, as you said, Alex, he loves that kind of situation certain times. So we're going to see a similar thing, but then Duvnjak is a way better defender.
So it's not letting it be 1-on-1. It's 1.5. Duvnjak is always going to be there at that right moment to support. And I think that could be the key difference.
For 60 minutes?
For 60 minutes. And he'll get a steal in the 57th minute to win the game.
So there you have it, a great debate. Some very strong opinions. Alex, you never let me down with some strong opinions.
Hey, well.
No, you had some very good...
Chris has some professional opinions.
Yeah. So there you have it. Let us know on Twitter what you think. Who won? Was it Chris O'Reilly or Alex Kulesh?
One of the biggest disappointments of EHF Euro 2020 were host nation Sweden, who could have gone all the way to their home final in front of 22,000 people in Stockholm, but instead are languishing down in fourth place in the main round group. We spoke to Swedish TV expert and former women's national team player Hanna Fogelström about the Swedish disappointment, some of the surprises in this championship, and a few more things.
So maybe you could start by maybe telling us or telling people outside of Sweden so how you came into the position you're in now. So you stopped playing due to injury and then you ended up behind the camera or in front of the camera.
Yeah, exactly, in front of the camera. It was just of a sudden, like 2 weeks before the World Championship for women in Germany 2017. And normally Per Johansson, who now is a coach for the Montenegro female team. And he just got the task to do it 2 weeks before the championship. So normally he was supposed to have my position on TV, but he, as a former coach, he said, of course I want to have this mission. So he went to Germany to coach the team instead. And then I don't know exactly how my name ended up in the TV staff, but I got a phone call and they said, hey, we heard good stuff about you. Do you want to be on TV and talk about Hamel? And I just have like one day to make my decision. And I never been doing TV before, just have had interview as a player. But I say, hey, I have to take the opportunity, so I went to do it. And luckily, I made a good one, because it would be really horrible to do like one or two appearances, and then you suck, and then you have to continue like 8 more games. But it was quite naturally for me to talk about handball, and it's there 2 or 3 cameras, you know, the red light, it's on, and if you want to look into it, you can do it. And always good producer, so they talk really good in my ear and give me feedback. So that's the start. And now we're here, 5 championships.
Yeah, you've been flying ever since. Yeah, in the space of just over 2 years, you've done every championship that's come your way. How has it changed for you? Has it become easy in the meantime? I mean, we were just talking in the way here that, like, still after 63 episodes of this, it's still not easy. But, I mean, are you becoming more comfortable day by day?
For sure, for sure. In the first at the first time, I didn't know what I could expect from myself. But now I feel that I really developed the two last championships in Japan for the women and now for the men's. I became more calm and better self-esteem and self-confidence. So I can also have a better analytic way and also don't have to be so prepared before, because I can just watch everything and I can talk from my head. I don't need to know what's the topic. So I feel more and more comfortable for everything I do, every time I do it.
Do you watch games differently now as an analyst compared to when you watch them as a player?
Yes, for sure. But I think also as a player, you should watch maybe a little bit more, because all the analytic part, it's your coach just delivering it for you. But you learn so much when you watch it. So you need to find a balance, of course, because as an athlete, you need to do a lot of stuff. But I learned very much when just analyzing the game. But sometimes I miss just to sit back in my couch, just watch and to enjoy. But you always sometimes, even if I don't need to do it, it's work mode on.
Always practicing.
Yeah, in one way it is.
And you're here mostly covering the Swedish men's team, and at these championships, the focus for Swedish TV is, of course, on the national team. For the women's team in particular, you know a lot of the players still very, very well. Has your appreciation for what it takes in the media changed during that time? And have you had any instances where you're like in doubt about what you're going to say about your former teammates or friends?
I think one of my strengths is that I'm very professional and I know why I'm there, and my job is to commentate how they perform on the field, not how they are as a person. So if you can just keep that separately, I think there's no problem. I think it's more hard sometimes to be hard on the coaches, because you cannot really see exactly how they perform. It's a lot like behind what you can see and hear on the camera. But as a player, if you miss five shots, I have to say that they can perform better. But I can always also relate to when I was a player, and I always was my biggest criticism. You know, if I was a bad, I know. Even if the media, like journalists on TV or newspaper, said that I was bad, I always thought that I was better than they think, if you can say that in English. I don't know.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
we had Gudjon Valur Sigurdsson on the last podcast, or two podcasts ago, actually, now. He was talking about that separation between you as a handball player and you as a person in real life, and how it's so important to keep that mindset when you're playing, because they're not attacking you as a player. Is this something you developed afterwards, or because you're saying you were your own worst critic when you were playing? Is this kind of a thing you realized afterwards, or something you knew when you were playing as well?
I think as a player as well, because sometimes like your parents or your friends can say, oh, did you saw what they write on you, like on the newspaper? And I say, yeah, I saw it, but I tried to avoid to read about it. But I was always more sad if I performed bad. I knew it before. I think sometimes people around me think it's a bigger problem than I think it's a problem. Because for me, it's easy to separate it.
But at the championship itself, it's long days, because I guess even when you're not in the studio, you're keeping an eye on what's happening, because you want to be prepared for the final weekend as well, the teams from the other groups. And in between the games as well, it seems like in these studios, you're always standing. You're always trying to watch the game, standing, eating, trying to do whatever. How is it for you these long evenings and keeping focused and thinking about what you're actually going to say when the lights come on?
Yeah, it's a lot more preparation than you can just see when we have our slots on TV, when we go live. And during the games, it's quite hectical, because you always have to take moments during the game and talk with someone in your ear sitting in the bus outside the arena who has to take some analytics parts. So you always have to have like 2 hours or 4 hours on the games, on the field, and also when you see the replays. Say, oh, okay, this we can talk about. And if there are tight games, it's even more difficult, because then you don't know if you want to say the positive or the negative things, if they win or if they lose. And also to prepare, like to analyze the game is one thing, but you also need the subject to talk about, so we produce good quality and not just like talk about random subjects. Yeah. So we always have meetings in the morning to build the program, because we often do like half an hour, 45 minutes before the game, and 1 hour after the game. So it's a lot of time to talk. So we need to be prepared. It's more than 8 hours a day if you work a normal 8 to 5, we say in Sweden.
So these events are more tiring as a media person almost than a player.
It's totally different. It's totally different. It's hard both ways, but it's just really, really fun, for sure. I really enjoy it, and also that we're always in the arena making the games, not in a studio, for example, in Stockholm. We are like where it happens, and that's a big thing for me to do it.
Yeah, same. I did the first half of the World Championship last year from a studio in Stockholm. I was in Munich 1 hour, and then I was in Copenhagen the next hour. But then being in out there in person and being in the arena is such a different thing. I'm not sure I can handle having somebody in my ear though while commentating.
Quite used to it, but I think like the what's better when you're on TV, if Sweden loses, it's easier for me to forget it and to move on. But as a player, when you lose, it stays in your head too long sometimes.
Let's talk about Sweden then, and this performance at the championship. You've probably seen them better than anyone else that we could speak to. Overall, there's no two ways about it. It's been a disappointment for them. A lot of different reasons have been thrown around, whether it be the players that were available or there were tactical issues as well. What do you feel were the key areas that led to their downfall?
Yeah, it's always difficult to find one key, and if it would be an easy answer, I think they will manage it and do it better. But if we go back a little bit, I think, of course, the injuries up to this tournament have been difficult, especially on the right side, as the right back, like Kim Andersson, everyone knows is a great player. And he just said in like October, until that, he said he will play. But then he had family issues and he said, no, it's private and I will not play. And then also have Mattias Zachrisson, he can play both wing and back. And they always like thought and have hopes that he could play, but in the end he couldn't. So they struggle, and up to the tournament, Albin Lagergren, think we thought he would play, but in the end he had a concussion. So then Sweden have to take a right-handed right back who never played there before. Maybe he played sometimes, but like Linus Arneson, he's not used to play there. So I think for those reasons, they've been really, really struggling in attack. And I think that's the biggest problem they had.
You felt like when Albin came back for the game against Norway, even though he might have been a bit ring rusty, like he just came back from the concussion protocol, that he gave a lot more balance to the team in attack, that's for sure. But still, even besides him, shooting in particular has been a huge issue. And something we were looking at yesterday was Ian Gottfriedsson, who, after his MVP performance 2 years ago, and he's been up and down in form in the last couple of years, but he just didn't seem to take as much responsibility as he used to. I think in 5 games, he had taken about 20, 23 shots, which is not a lot for a kind of run-and-gun centre-back like him.
Albin, to go back with Evo Lagerin, I think, of course, it's another dimension in the attack when you can have a left-handed, for sure. But with Jim, I think it's also difficult for him because he needs good player around him to also so they take some space, and not just that he has to create the space. So with also Kimmich Dodurie on the left back, sometimes he eats a lot of space. I think he's a great player and he can do a lot, but sometimes it's too much. And maybe he's not the best to take the small decisions in the end. And Jim is a really smart player. So I think the balance sometimes in the team, I don't know if it's the perfect combination. So I think there's a lot of things. But of course, Gottfriedsson needs to shoot more. He cannot just pass and pass and pass. And I think Sweden lack speed in their attack. Sometimes it's too much, 2 against 2, and they want to play all the way to a 6-meter shot. But they also need to make easy goals from outside the field.
Are there any particular positives you take from the squad? Any like the fact that 2 young wing players got a start yesterday was quite exciting. They didn't deliver so much at the beginning, but there's a lot of talent in there.
But also, as a wing player, you need to have back players that they can play you. Yeah. So you can
That's the wing player, and you.
Yeah, of course, I know how it is to be like ice cold on the wing, but it is a problem, and they are skilled. So of course, we need to use them, and they are young stars, and they also perform good. It's not just they score goals; they do it in a nice way for the spectators in the arena, but also for the TV. So of course, there are some positive things, and they are the future. But we also need future on the backs. But I think always in Sweden we talk about defense and goalkeepers. And if we take the game against Portugal away, I think we are strong in defense. And Palicka, like, of course, Apergin is also good, but Palicka been better this tournament. And you can tell that he's really enjoying playing at home. And he gets so much energy from people around him. So that are the positive things, but Sweden have a lot to develop into the future. But we can also see other teams that didn't do their best performance, but you just need to bounce back as fast as possible.
We're talking about bouncing back in the future, but clearly for this team and for the federation and everyone involved, building up to this championship was a big thing. I mean, having yes, it's a three-nation championship, but in reality for Sweden, they were the hosts. They were going to be home for the whole way. This must have been, in reflection, quite a big disappointment for them.
For sure, and after the game against Portugal, we heard a lot of the Swedish, like the players, and they were really disappointed and they were almost ashamed to perform that bad when they are at home, and it's not nice as a player to do it. And it's not that they want to do it like that. They really try their best, but sometimes things just not work, you know? And it's very frustrating. And if you start bad, it's also hard to end that circle and to forget it. And you say, oh, let's go on zero and we go better than this. But you can see that in the arena, there are less people. So let's see how Stockholm will perform. I don't know. I hope, because it's my home country, but it's sports. You cannot plan, you cannot schedule for everything.
And do you expect now a lot of changes? Because it's interesting what you said about the mismatch, or kind of some of the players not really kind of combining together. Because I was watching Kim play and it looked like he was a player from a different team almost, thrown in there. And then his comments then about saying he might retire after his contract is up in PSG. Mm. What does the future hold for this kind of group of players? Do you see them coming ever in this combination again, or do you think there'll be massive changes for the next event?
Yeah, we will see, because there's also a new coach. So I don't know exactly what his core is and what he wants to do with this team and to develop it. And it's really soon, it's Olympic qualification. Yeah. So how much can it change? So he needs to learn the players and what type of handball he wants to play. I think it's one of the keys are that they should play a lot in their home clubs. And you can tell sometimes when they're a lot on the bench, they lack self-esteem when they come to the national team, and also with the timing. So I think sometimes it's good to change team. Of course, it's good if they play in the top teams around Europe, but for the men's, there's a lot of good teams. So maybe some players need to change clubs so they play a lot and they develop, and also that they need to play in both attack and in defense. I think that's why, one of the reasons why Norway is really good.
Do you think they overachieved in 2016?
18.
2018, sorry, excuse me.
When they took the silver in Croatia. But this is a team sport. And I think that's one of the strengths that Sweden have had before and should have now also, that they are a team. But other teams also learn that it's important to not just be good as a player, you need to be good as one. So it's a lot about timing as well.
Looking away from Sweden then, you've had an eye on a lot of teams, particularly here in the main round in Malmö. Any teams in particular that have surprised you in a very positive way?
I think there are two teams. It's Portugal and Hungary. So, but they do it in a different way and different style of playing handball. Portugal, I know that people talked before about in this tournament because they beat France.
France in qualification.
Exactly. So I know that France was really nervous for the opening game. And you can tell Portugal, they knew what they stand for and they did it very well. And now maybe they lack a little bit of energy for the moment, but I think we will see them again because they have things to develop, but they also have a good base to stand on. And then Hungary, no one thought before. No one had any expectations on them. I think they had on themselves because they knew what they could perform, but they are the youngest team here, but they are still doing good. And they're always bouncing back in games as well. So very good team spirit.
On this podcast, we've been huge nerds about Portuguese handball for the last 2 years and big fans of it. And on club level, they've shown so much potential. And one of our colleagues, Marcio, who's Portuguese, and the way he waxes lyrical about these players. Mm-hmm. And as you said, they've got a great base to work with. A lot of players who are just early 20s now, or some barely even 20 years old. And I felt like a couple of days ago, that first loss in the main round, it was almost like the realization that they were not just everyone's surprise package, that, oh my God, we've actually got something to fight for here, and we've actually expected to win some games now. So it'll be interesting to see how they deal with it mentality-wise, but based on how they play in the Champions League, the Porto players, for example, beating Kiel away from home, beating Montpellier away from home, they're certainly mentally strong boys.
Yeah, the expectation came on very quickly. I mean, they qualified, it was like the biggest thing ever.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they're here and they're expected to win all of these games.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, but it turns fast. If you do good, people expect that. You know, it's like in 2 seconds you become a star, and then everyone expects you to always be a star. So of course now it's important to them to continue to do this, and even if they do good performance with club teams, it's of course in Hamel world, if you watch like Hamel daily, you know it. But I think you need a breakthrough with the national team.
I think the Portuguese also a nation of sporting people, that they kind of hold their sporting heroes at a very high regard as well. So you're a hero one minute and you're a villain the next minute, you know. So
yeah, but it's also industry, you know, and if it's more like nationwide, you get more money and you can invest in a good way. So you need to perform to develop as well.
Also lovely climate to play your handball in, I think. It's also, it helps a lot, I think.
For sure. But I'm not really sure if I like the 7-6. But it's a whole other chapter. We don't need to talk about details with that. But
you can talk about it for hours, I'm sure.
But they do it very well. I mean, they do it very seamlessly.
They do it very, very well. And they also do it with more speed than other teams. Yeah. So I'm impressed what they do, but I'm not sure if I want to handle to develop in that way. Yeah. That's just a different way.
It was the same with Sävehof's men's team last year as well, right? A lot of 7-6, and people kind of gave a lot of credit to them for achieving what they achieved, winning the championship that way. But yeah, there's a lot of purists who still who will never accept it.
Yeah, yeah. But if you want to win games, do it the way you can do it. Yeah.
So what then about the biggest disappointments then in your book for this Euro? Teams which have, if you had to pick two or three names, which teams have been the biggest disappointments?
We already talked about Sweden, so they are. But I didn't expect them to win gold, but still, it's disappointing because it's home and they didn't like perform well. Except from that, of course, it's France. They didn't even make it to the main round. It's a big disappointment, and yeah, it's not good for them. But then I would also say Denmark, because I know it's in Sweden, but Denmark is very close to Malmö, and it's almost their home field, and they are world championship and Olympic champions, and everyone was talking about, not at least themselves, that they want to make the triple.
Yeah.
But you cannot talk without acting and performing. So I think maybe Denmark is the biggest because they didn't show any kind of level.
No.
Oh, the first game against Iceland, it was a very nice handball game, but the lack defense, I think, during that game, attack is fine, but the other games, I couldn't recognize them.
Yeah, which is so strange because before the tournament, they looked so amazing. Mm. On the run up to it, we were watching them. Remember the Golden League before that, the night before we flew, and we're like, oh my God, there's no one's going to beat, gonna even come close to them. And then they turn up, and it's like they're a completely different side all of a sudden, which was really bizarre.
Yeah, but it's weird how it can change in 1 year. And maybe just 1 week. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you have to win the right games. But I think it's nice that the Hamel map sometimes changes a little bit and other nations get hope up that they can beat the best. Yeah. Because it's big. It's important for the sport to grow a little bit. It cannot be too centralized in a few teams.
Sure. I think it's nice for like the super nerds when things change up a little bit. but for the standard handball fan who's sitting at home and maybe their country isn't in the Euro anymore or didn't qualify or whatever. Mm. For those fans, do you think it takes away a bit of the shine when the big players like Karabatic and Hansen aren't here anymore?
Yeah, you need the profile, of course, because it's important for the sports and they can follow and they get confused, I think.
Yeah.
And also like role models for kids. It's like, oh, but who can I have now? Maybe he wasn't that good. Maybe
Rui Silva. They went and buy some the glasses.
I think, like, you don't have to go to the semifinal, but the big nations and the name nations need to go to the main round and to play to the semifinals. Before the championship, when they extended it to 24 games, I thought it was really positive, and I think, okay, it's going to be fight all the way to the end. But what happened? There's a lot of games that's not interested in anymore. Because they are already through to the semifinals. So I don't know if the EHF have to develop or it was just like this championship that happens some things. You need to have these close games because otherwise you lose the spectators.
You need consistency from those big nations as well, I think, and to a certain extent, because you lose that and then it's just random results and people are like, what am I watching here exactly?
The first round opened up this trap door for these big nations. We saw with France and Denmark being knocked out in the group phase because only two teams go through. And it meant that the 12 teams that went through maybe aren't at all at the level required. So in one way, it was super exciting at the start because some teams are knocked out. And I think it was Danish TV had a look at the stats. And overall, the difference, like the goal difference in matches, is actually the same as it was 2 years ago. Like the amount of like 9-goal victories are the same as before. So there's not as many thrashings, which is something you might expect with an expansion. But at the same time, particularly in the group in Vienna, the lower teams were much lower. And I think we all saw that before it even started. We were like, okay, groups D, E, F, when they go to Malmo, are going to be really tight. And then groups A, B, and C, there's two teams which really stand out. And those two teams were Spain and Croatia who went.
But just let's hope that it would be a good thing in the end, because every team now needs to be even better. So you cannot just sit back and say, oh, we are good. You need to develop. So they also will have a big step to make now for the Olympics and for the next championship. Hopefully every team take the next level and we can enjoy even better games in the next World Championship or Olympics or Euro or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think teams like the Netherlands and Latvia are going home thinking, look, that was a great tournament. I mean, we really performed at that level. You know, we belong here to a certain extent because they had some good games, or at least good portions of games.
What do you think about the expansion? We saw the expansion to 24 teams, but also having in three different nations. And, you know, Norway and Sweden side by side, yes, but then Austria all the way over and Central Europe. For you, I guess you haven't been exposed to it so much, as you were in Gothenburg and then you come down here to Malmö, you'll be in Stockholm. But what's your impression of spreading the love like that, so to speak?
Of course, when the home nation is playing the first round, it's good because you have a lot of spectators in the arena and it just brings another level to the game for everyone. But maybe three are one too much, I think. I think two works good. But three also for the players to move and to fly and also to feel the atmosphere in the country. If you move too much, it's difficult to feel the whole temperature. So I think two nations, it's good also to spread the money and the arenas and the ticket selling. I think you need to look at all the parameters to see what's best. And also the EHF have to take responsibility. So for now, example, when they have to fly in from Austria, we also need and want to have fresh players, so the semifinals is good. So you also need to find the best logistic way to do it so the players can perform.
Yeah, countries that aren't landlocked, I think it's a very strange way to do things. I mean, I think when it's Norway and Sweden, it's fine, but then Austria is so far away. I mean, I saw that Croatia, Denmark and Norway are also playing for the World Championships in 2025. And it just seems like three really random countries to...
Yeah, but if you take the airplane, it doesn't matter if you take the bus for hours or the airplane. It's fine, but maybe you need to do it in a smooth way. But also for the spectators, to expect them to fly from country to country and to buy tickets in different than the hotels. I don't have the answers and I didn't do any research, but you need to think about that also because we need them in the arenas. So what's also practical for them to move all the time or not?
There's very few countries, I think, at the moment that can host a championship like this on their own. We have Germany will host 2024. I think the men's championship. But besides that, if you look at the world championships, which will be extended to 32 teams, the women's Euro will soon be 24 teams as well. Can you think of any other countries that might actually be able to host it all in one country?
Ooh. I didn't thought about that before. No, but of course the quality for the arenas needs to be good.
Yeah, exactly.
And you also need to be able to sell tickets in one country. So maybe not. But I think if you do it in two countries, I don't see it's a problem. Yeah. Actually, you always have to think what's best for the handball in the long way. You cannot just think about one championship. So there's so much more what we know and what the people know that watch the sports. You need to trust the people who make the decision. But we always have to talk about it so we don't like sit back and rest. it's always open for discussion.
Coming from the media perspective, then, these new statistics that we've been given in this championship, do you think they're something which are nice for the fans, or is it something that you've been using in your moderation?
Normally, I think it's very good to use the statistic during the championship because you cannot watch all the games. You also sometimes need to see statistic, and maybe then you know what to look for because you cannot stream every game. Or you can, maybe then you will not sleep.
Yeah.
But I have to say, before, EHF were always behind and EHF were always better. But this championship, when they tried to build a new technology, so I think the idea is good, but the quality is not that good. And as the basic stats that's been trustfully before, I cannot trust it this championship. I don't know what it is, but I know they're struggling in the beginning of the championship.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good idea, but you cannot lose the quality in it. For example, like the stat, who shoots the hardest shots, yeah. You know? We try to put it in one of our TV programs, and then we saw like, oh, this was the highest, and then you go and track the minutes, and when you see it, it's like, ah, maybe it's not true, and then you cannot use it.
Interesting.
So it's always quantity or quality.
Yeah.
So they need to be sure to do it in the best way, because it can be really useful.
Quickly looking ahead then to the final weekend. Here in Malmö, Norway have been the absolutely dominant team. It's always difficult to compare groups, but when you look at Vienna as well, the two sides that are going to the semi-finals, Spain and Croatia, how do you think these styles match up? And is there any team that Norway should be afraid of at this stage?
I think they're really afraid of Spain. They more or less never won against them. So they are afraid, but I think what's really interesting, it's the defense differences. Like Spain and Croatia play more offensive, like 5-1 or 3-2-1. They are really attacking. And here it's more in the group of Norway and Slovenia or Hungary, we will see now. They play more like traditional, like 6-0, you know. So we'll see what will be the best maybe. So it's two different way of playing handball.
If we forced you to throw out a winner at this stage, who would you go for?
I would say Norway. They are really sharp in all the small details. If you look at turnovers, like technical fouls, they have 5. And the other team has 8, 9, 10. And it was the same with Denmark last year in the World Championship. So they don't do mistakes, not only like the stupid mistakes, but they take like an easy way just to run back. They do it. Like in their head, they really want to win this and they don't want to give it away. If they get beaten, they have to be beaten by like a better team. Not that they didn't perform their best, but the other team were better. If a team will beat them, it's Spain.
Hanna Fogelström, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
It was nice talking to you too.
Enjoy the rest of the championship.
Thank you.
I think for a lot of handball fans out there, and for us, we've always discussed this, that the motivation behind coming a referee, especially a referee at the very top level, is something I never fully understood. And so we had the opportunity at this Euro to sit down with two referees, two top referees, and discuss all of your questions that you sent in on Twitter, plus many more things, the life of a referee at an EHF Euro. So we hope you enjoy it. This is Boris Milosevic and Matija Gubica. When we were talking about this, it's one thing I've always thought. There's two things I don't understand in handball. One, how you become a handball goalkeeper, or two, how you become a referee. So what was the motivation for you guys to become a referee in the first place?
It's a good question. What's the motivation? We played, both of us, 10 years. And then in one moment, it was 1999, 21st of April. I know everything.
Wow.
Yeah. it was, let's say, some course for new referees. And in that moment in Croatia, in those parts where we are living, almost all clubs was or second division or a little bit low. And we say to ourselves, we would like to stay in handball. Let's try with handball refereeing. There is no some, you know, that we get some motivation from I don't know where. And we go to this course. In that moment, only that first year, Boris and I we've been on the same course, but we didn't been couple in that moment. And when we start to whistle, in one moment we whistle together too, we feel immediately that we could be good in this, you know. And then after year by year, we saw that we was in that moment right. And then we decide almost immediately, when we start now to be a referee, let's give our best on every game and to see how far we can go. Thinking like this, it's still in every game on our mind, and we are really giving our best in every game just to see how far we can go. But we never had some pressure, you know, we must be this or some crazy ideas. We want to whistle like a final of Euro or a final of a World Championship. But when you have approach what we had, then in our case, we did it. We had a final of Euro, we have final of Women's and Men's World Championship. We only need the final, I hope, of Olympic Games, and then it's something what you can do in a referee life. That's it. There is no more after that. We have semi-final from London, but if we go this year, first we need to go. In some case, if we get final of Olympic, that's it then. That's a triple. It's not triple-double, but...
Then you give up. But, Boris, did you... you knew each other then before as players?
Yeah, of course. We played together.
Oh, come on. No, we didn't know each other. Come.
You have a completely different story how to start it out.
Yeah, the truth.
He's like, we had a great connection. He's like, oh, who's this guy?
I don't know what I'm doing in this room with him. Yeah, so. Yeah, but you know, we were playing together in the same team, maybe, and after what Mattia told, certain stasis put the teams that we were playing go to the second or the third division, because in this part of the our region. And then we decide, okay, we are not so good players to be national team players. And then we decide, okay, let's try to do us something new. And then we choose to go, okay, let's go to the pass this course, and then we pass it. And maybe the crucial thing is what Mattia forget to mention it. It's that when we started to do this, we never had a plan to be on that kind of the level what we are now here. We are just enjoying in this, and till this moment, we're still enjoying this. After that, when we feel that not anymore enjoying, probably we're going to stop it or here. And that's, I think, the most important thing that if you're doing any job, you need to have power, you need to have to enjoy it. Just enjoy it, and that's the job what you're doing.
Motivation.
How do you describe each other's roles? Because working as a pair, as a couple...
Okay, you want to ask who is a wife, who is a man? Yeah.
But sure, I guess there are certain situations where, I mean, you try to set each other up, or you would have a feeling that you know, you have to back each other up, or somebody's going to make a certain decision. There is there something like that in refereeing?
Usually, from the first day, we know what's part of the field have one, and what part of the field have another one. When you are goal referee, field referee, you have different roles, of course. But what you mean, maybe some mistakes what one have, you know, another one have, that's normal. And we look on that like normal things. And we always say in every game, who have 3-4 mistakes on each side in the game, he's really, really good referee. It's impossible to whistle without mistakes. Only his problem is if it's 8 mistakes on one side and 0 on another one, then it's something bad, you know.
Then
but
we have
if
a
it's
problem.
3-4 here, 3-4 there, that's absolutely normal. We always say to young colleagues too, you know, when we teach them players, they are training, some of them, most of them, 2 times per day. Some of them maybe even 3 times per day. And they still miss penalty shot, clear shot, you know, and that's normal. This is something what we want to coaches understand too, you know. We are human beings, and it's really impossible of 150 or 200 decisions per match in today's handball. It's impossible to be 100% correct, you know. Yeah. But if it's 3-4 there, 3-4 here, and then when he's making mistakes, for me, that's normal. I know I will make it probably in three attacks after the same one.
This is the normal when I made mistakes. Yeah.
So you're aiming for perfection, but perfection is impossible.
You aim to be, let's say, almost perfection, 99%, but perfection is like in life. Yeah. It's impossible. You strive to be best, and that's a good thing. But if you are striving to be, you know, perfect, it's impossible.
Yeah,
it's really impossible.
It's one thing. Another thing I never understood as well is that, I mean, everyone knows that the players want to play in those big games, the finals, semifinals, and get up there and play on the big stage. But one thing that people kind of forget about is the referees also want to whistle or to referee those matches, the big matches. And that's something I never understood. I'm like, that's way too much responsibility. That's probably why I'm not a referee. I want to stay away from those big games. Maybe want to play in them, but not be responsible for making those decisions. Talk to us a bit about some of the bigger games you've been involved in and what it was like for you.
Everybody wants to be on the top position, of course, and even the players, even the referees. The responsibility for that kind of the match, for the finals and everything, of course, there is a pressure. There's a big pressure. You try to move from your mind, from everything, your pressure, but one mistake can decide the winner or the loser. Especially in the finals, you can be the European or World Champion or Olympic champion. But with experience and with the games, you need to adapt in your head that final should be like ordinary, normal game. And if you fix it in that your mindset, that is just a normal, usually game, just a normal, unquoted, normal game, then you probably will control everything and your pressure in the mind will be a little bit down, and then you can manage it during the game and everything. So the players also, even the players, okay, they know they're playing the final, but for them, who first get adapted into the head that is the normal, usually game, they will probably in an advantage on the other side. Because if you're going to mindset that you are okay, now in final, it's watching me 50 million people, it's 20,000 spectators in the sport hall, then you probably going down, 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 down. But you need to build up your before the game and say, okay, this is the normal game. We have this game, this is the final, this is the decisive moment. Focusing much, much more on everything, because it's really one mistake can decide the winner or the loser. But it's like in other games. Also, one match can one ball can decide who's going to be winner, who's going to be the loser.
But you are, Brian, absolutely correct. I can understand you. You know, it's what Boris say. You are trying every game, you know, to put pressure down. But in today's handball, from day to day, how time is going, it's more and more difficult. You know, it's faster handball, more decisions, more medias, audience. So it's in many games on this level, it's not easy, especially because in one team you have if you something do bad, you have all your teammates who will tell to you, don't worry, that's normal. And we have only two of us. If you did a good job, you know, explanation is, of course, you are top level referees. That's
your job.
Expecting this from you. But if you something do bad, you know, one mistake is enough to do it bad, then you are almost alone, you know, because then everybody are against you. Medias, players, one team, another team.
But comparing for also for the handball and this pressure, what we are talking now, compare
With football, it's not.
No, it's football. Yeah, it's a joke. Yeah, but when you compare pressure from the media or outside, just compare 10 years ago or 15 years. What was the media interest for the handball, and what is the media interest now for this situation? And this is the product is growing up, and everything is.
This what you're doing now, we didn't have even 3 years ago. You know.
Yeah.
And now we have it. Probably in 2 more years from now, you will have something.
TV studio.
Yes. Two robots.
Yeah.
In the past, you had 2 cameras. Now you have, I don't know how many cameras, 15 on the games. And even our mistakes, we have, when we watch
everybody
it, we analyze
it
every day. It's from the 10, 15 angles, you know. And it's today, it's really, we need to be focused 60 minutes to stay calm and make good decisions.
It's interesting what you said there about you only have each other. at the end of the day. And I'd say particularly when you go to league games and European Cup, Champions League games, that's very clear. But at these major championships, you're surrounded as well by other referees and the delegates and Dragan as the leader of the referees. What's the interaction like between you then on a daily basis during the championship? Is it all about refereeing, kind of sharing tips, making jokes about what may have happened? Or do you try to stay away from the topic when you're having lunch and dinner?
Let's say mix. Most of it is, of course, handball. You know, but today we was together, Chris, you and me in gym, and there was
pumping iron,
a few more pumping little, and there was a few more colleagues there, and it's you could see we have really interaction between us, like real friends. You know, some other when we come home ask us, oh, you know, who whistle? You didn't whistle. They whistle. You know, from the first day, I think everybody here, and it's usually a championship. Don't care who is whistling, because we know sometimes is some neutral factors important. Sometimes is your team is in, not in. And we all want to give to our friends support. And when they make mistakes, nobody's happy, because we know we can be tomorrow in the same situation, you know. And we are really team here. And when somebody is not good, that influence on all others. You know, we are trying really then what you say, this is opportunity to be together. And we are trying then to put all the heads together and stay calm and go next match, be better. You know, so it's
something like family, you know. Yeah. We need to live together for 20 days, 25 days together. And it's when you have a bad situation, it's really influence on everybody, you know, because you need to, this is your friend tomorrow, you will go have the match, you will probably have another situation which maybe cause the same problems what I have the day before. But after that, trying to the lunch or sad dinner or breakfast, trying to little bit to not talk about to relax, talking about ordinary life things, you know. It's nothing, just don't put the pressure on the handball, because 20 days, if you're living only the handball, then you will gonna become the crazy, or I don't know, jump from the window. So it's...
Look, I think it's the same with you, you know. You can joke and laugh on some other things, but still on mine you have this, what you are doing, and most of things is around this, because this is, handball is our life for Boris and me last 30 years. You know, we are 10 years players, now 20 years referees, and it's, you cannot run from that. That's your life. That's part of us. And then we can say each other when, you know, at home, when we don't have a game, sometimes on the weekend, it's maybe in a week, but weekend is free. Then we say each other, it's crazy, you know. It's we are not used to it that we are at home. We like it, but it's different, you know.
Different responsibilities. Then.
Different responsibilities, yeah.
So in that sense, it sounds like it's a little bit easier then when you have a Champions League game and you go home on your own and you go back the next day and maybe you didn't have your best game and you have to kind of sit with your own thoughts, whereas here you're surrounded by referees and maybe, as you said, they can pick you up a little bit.
Okay, when we are talking about this, Matija mentioned that we are two alone of us. Of course, there you have a bad days, you have the bad games and everything. But you need to know how to live with mistakes. Okay, so if you made the bad performances, you need to analyze to get all negative turn around to the positive things, to see what was the wrong, to feel it, and then growing up with this negative to become the positive. So sometimes it's really difficult, but thanks God we didn't have this bad situation that we are going down into some depressed or something, that kind of the situations. But you need to live it. And this is what I always compare like a tennis player, you know. Tennis player, if he is thinking about the ball what he missed it point before, he's going to miss another point and then going there. So this is also like in the refereeing. Okay, we have a half of the second, 1 second to decide. Is it good or it is a bad? What kind of decision is it? If it's bad, we need to live with this bad decision. Okay, forget it and move on. Let's go because it's... And then, but after the match, you analyze everything. And then if it's bad performance, then you need to be critic to yourself, first of all. Start from yourself and then what I do to not make mistakes, what Mattia made to not make this mistake, and what we, like a couple, do it to avoid any things for the future and everything. So it's, but after 2 hours, 3 hours, when you get it, your mind off, then you are fix it again, and okay, we are stepping back and we are on the back track, on the track again, and that's it.
Yeah, I presume you stay away from comments under videos online and stuff like that. If you maybe had not your best game ever, you don't go on reading comments from fans or anything like that.
You're right. Usually don't.
Yeah.
We really usually don't, because I personally think I don't like those anonymous comments. You know, I respect everybody, but if you want to say something, then put your name in front and say it loud and clear. Then I can respect this. This, what somebody writing or not writing, that's his right, of course. But we all know 99% of those comments are extremely subjective. And if your team lose, then it's bad comments. If your team won, then it's good comments. And our decision is here. You know, if they won, we are fantastic. If they lose, then we are bad. You know, so this is the reason why we usually, I think Boris have the same opinion, usually don't read this. Maybe from time to time,
come
you know.
On,
to...
I'm one of the anonymous, you know. Yeah, I'm putting it.
And in this constant pursuit of the, like, trying to reduce the mistakes as much as possible, which we know is almost impossible in handball, is instant replay. And in the last few years, it's been growing in handball, and I think has been used very well at this championship. A lot of comparisons are used to football as well, because in the last year or so, it's become a big part in football. And I mean, if you look at the Premier League, for example, it seems to be an absolute disaster. But here in handball, you seem to have a lot more control over it. You know the exact situations which can be used in. Yeah. How do you perceive it, and like what does instant replay mean to you too as referees?
But when you ask me about the same opinion, probably we're gonna have it about this video technology. Let's say technology using, I think it's fantastic. Whatever. Okay, we are not talking about football in a Premiership. What's happening with there? But I think that in handball we are on the good way to use this technology, because the only question is. And a really good question is, get the right decision. No matter what is, did you perform this or this, but get the right decision. Okay, there is a few things, what should be done, it put it on the paper, how to use this technology. Okay, we have now this opportunity to see some situations, to have really correct decision about a red card or a 2 minutes or something like this. But maybe for the future, to improve some kind of the situations, where we can also use it in some kind of the positions, or what is it, this or is it this, but that should be really careful with this, and should be some procedures, put it on the table or on the paper to see how it's going to be managed. But I think if everybody is doing in all sports, if you want to grow up as a sport, I think that we should use this video technology, because handball is, and you know, it's going fast and faster, so it's really, and the players are using this dirty fouls, you know, and everything, that it's really, sometimes it's really not possible to see from the angle of the position of the referee, but when you have the angle from the opposite side of the camera, then you can see really what happened in this situation, because only two of us, four eyes, and we cannot cover everything, especially when come three or four players on the one. Yeah, who hit somebody? I don't know. Everybody's falling down. I don't know. Now I need help, you know. It's not possible.
Yeah, but that's normal again. But what you say, Chris, maybe because we have strict situations, yes, and guidance, yeah, when we can use it, maybe that's the reason why it's, for now, it's so good. Because it's really few situations when you can use it, red or blue, two or red. If something happened behind your back, you know, you could not see. We cannot use it for steps, for double, for. And then when I saw some players, you know, to showing
the TV gesture, yeah, yeah.
Look, they probably or don't know, or maybe they know, but still little bit provoke. But we cannot use it for any situation in the match. We have strictly goal, no goal, red card, something from behind the back, and that's it. You know, all other things are still on our own. And then when he showed me, you know, video, I would say to him, my friend,
2 minutes.
Not today.
Yeah, it's almost a bit like poker, isn't it? Look, go check. Yeah, it's like, but I mean, how do you control that? How do you not avoid creating a culture where everyone's just going to be making that shape with their?
I think that. Probably all players, most of them know how it's going, or even coaches, but maybe coaches didn't tell them, you know, they have some other things on mind, of course, when we can use it. And they probably thinking we can use it, you know. And then when you see that, Boris and I, we always have on mind that's in the games. It's always emotions and they want to win, you know. And in 95%, I'm sure they are doing this because they really think we can check. You know, so you are trying not to, to think about that like provocation. But if he is doing 5-6 times per match same player, then what Chris say? 2 minutes, my friend, now this is provocation.
Now you will learn.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess things like that are a good way to maybe deal with the culture. And first of all, teaching people what you're allowed to check. And then, and second of all, then instilling a bit more discipline. And respect for the referees. And we see it in some sports, there's very little, and then other sports like rugby where only the captain can talk to the referees is the opposite end of it. I mean, is there anything in that sense, like in the way that referees are being dealt with, or even maybe with rules, that if you had to choose one thing you could change tomorrow, that you would?
Maybe tough question, because 4 years ago, when it was...
Yeah, some changes of the rules. Yeah, that was
big changes. Yeah, 4 or 5 years ago, it was most of things. What then is done changed was now are really good.
Yeah,
you know.
But I know what kind of the question you want. You want to ask me about passive play or something like this? No, yeah, no. I'm getting the shot clock
or time attack or something. Yeah. Like that.
We actually asked fans. We actually asked listeners for questions because we knew you were coming on.
Okay.
The questions to your referees.
Okay.
And that was one of them. Yeah. If you could change a rule in the morning, what would it be?
Okay, maybe talking about media, about everything, that we should have some clock like in basketball. To be honest, for the referees, we are avoiding this subjective decision from the side of the referee. When we're going to put the hand up or not, how many decide. If you have this clock, it's okay, then you're depending on the time. But it's it's easy to say, but to get it into implementation, if the rules, it's really difficult, because you know the handball is the basketball is not contact sport.
Yeah.
Every time you touch, time is stopping. Yeah. Handball is a contact sport; nothing is stopped till the referees give the timeout. So there is lots of the questions, open questions, still to be determined and get the answer. How it should be solved if you get this shot clock, and how it's going to be. Is it going to be 35, 45, 50 seconds? It's,
and what happens then when you get a foul?
What's happening with this time? And then you will probably, maybe from the side of defense, lots of the aggressive defense, foul, shot clock is going down. Then it's going to be some shots from the 10 meters, no more goals anymore, and then...
The wingers don't touch the ball anymore.
Yeah, it's not easy how it looks
like, you know.
Everybody wants, you know, but it's lots of the open questions who needs to put it on the table and to answer.
Do you feel that calling of passive play, so the moment that you find that the hand goes up, that it's being refined, that it's improving with every championship, that every time you come together and with the knowledge growing every time, that you're getting closer and closer to a one line in every championship?
My personal opinion is yes. And I think those rule is a really good rule, much better than the in the past, how it was. You know, now you have at least players all know, they accept it. They know they have 6 passes maximum. Of course, if they are not doing anything on a second pass, you can take the ball. But I think they, I will not say like the rule, but it's much better than the rule in the past about passive play.
Another question was, what's the most difficult call to make at the moment? I think for a lot of fans, maybe attack or foul is probably one which people don't really understand sometimes, because it seems to become a bit of a grey area.
Absolutely right, yeah. It's because attacker in the air, defender, is a defender in the first position, or it's on the, then you must...
And it's milliseconds.
It's milliseconds, then you need to know the attacker, when he's attacker in the air, he cannot change his moving path then in that moment. So it's really, and as we said, we are not basketball, we are the contact sport, and then it's sometimes, but okay, we have some common line and we are doing them, we have some integrated into the rules and everything, how it's have procedure, what we, and about this attacking fall, it's everything about anticipation, how it's going to finish. Because if you have open gap between the two players, and when it's player, of course, that he's going to jump. And now in that moment, if they close and in the air, that's probably it's going to be the 7 meter, not clear offensive foul. So it's something that we have something in the, by experience, by the rules and everything. So it's, this is also, tough call, really tough call, because you need a half a second to decide from inside or outside where it started. So it's that's the problem. If you don't see immediately when the defender,
if he's inside, if they can be 7 meter. Then if it's outside, then can be empty. You know, it's really, if you, we comment in many situations, if you only see the last part of the situation, then it's not good. You know, sometimes player can use the space and then go out, but still he make advantages because he use it 1 meter inside or something like that. But he's then, in the last moment, he is already out. But still he used space to gain advantages. And then if he get some advantage from that movement, it must be like he's in inside, no matter what, he's now outside, you know. So it's many difficult situations. That's the reason why we have every day the analysis and watching the games, many clips every day. I don't know, Dragan put on the screen. No, that's normal. We must do it. But we, every day we have three games, and in from each games he have 20, 30 clips, and he put 10. You know, but still, that's 30 clips and discussion after each clip. If he have something to ask, you know, it's. We are working really hard to improve ourselves, but sometimes, you know, in those fast handball, 1 millisecond is really dangerous.
Do you think that knowing the players and the way they operate on the court is even more important then, because of the speed of the game? And there are certain players who, like you said, might try to use advantages in certain ways, certain behaviors they display. Does knowing the way that they play help that, or do you try to look at it from a completely, like, maybe neutral, of course, but not making any assumptions about how players behave?
Excellent question, because, you know, the teams are preparing for themselves for the next team, who is also, as we the referees, we know who's going to teams are going to whistle next game, and of course we know each other, all the players from these teams, because you know them for a long time. And then you can know, you know what to expect from some kind of the players. But to not be high focusing on this player, you said, Chris, that yes, we need to come totally neutrally on the game. But you know, you have, let's say, eyes on this player, and you are aware what he is capable to do, especially in defense, what in attack and everything. And you take care about this situation. So we are preparing also for the game, like the teams analyzing opposite team. So this is what we also do for the players and everything else. So it's really preparing. But when you get on the court, it's really starting from the zero. But you have some somewhere in the mind, okay, be careful on this number or this number, because he was a little bit dangerous last match. He was doing something dirty things. Okay, he's too fast, maybe some steps and something like this, but we are preparing yourself for also for this.
Now, would you prepare yourself emotionally now when you're going to certain places as well, knowing that this crowd here can be very tough on referees?
Of course, the same. You know, you are prepared. Okay, we have, even in this our regional league, Seha league, it's many courts that it's lots of people inside, you know,
nice, and the atmosphere, you know, is
arena full of referees.
We are, let's say, used to it, but of course, sometimes, you know, you need additional preparation for this. But about those players, I think that our preparation, especially for top referee group here, for the players, we know them for 5-6 years, you know. We really don't need to prepare like in the past when we start, you know, to watch especially this player or this one.
No, now even we on when you have analyzed, it's forbidden to comment this or this player. It's only situation. You know, usually when we have clips, we are not talking, oh, this player is dirty player. No, no, no. We only show situations and work on situations. But it's easier for us because I really think they respect us totally and we respect them totally. You know, it's some mutual. And there's a reason why I think it's a little bit easier. But still, of course, if some new team, let's say, come to Champions League, usually they are not playing there, then you a little bit more watching them to see what you can expect, what you say. Audiences there is a little bit noisy than on other places, but that's normal. That's usual what we do in everyday life.
You enjoy the pressure.
No pressure, no fun.
No pressure, no fun. I think that's a perfect way to end it. Yeah. Guys, thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure. Really, really informative as well. Really, really nice.
A real bumper episode to wrap up the main round and guide us into the big semi-final weekend in Stockholm. So we're getting on a first-class flight there.
And we hope you enjoy the games. And as we say in Russian, Alex...
На здоровье.